year's Proms Plus Late, where the Proms goes upstairs at the Royal Albert Hall to the atmospherically lit Elgar Room and settles back with a glass of something soothing for some late-night fare in the form of live poetry and music. We start the season off this evening with those two beautifully matched bedfellows, poetry and jazz. And the jazz comes courtesy of the Alex Woods Quintet, who have braved a single-lane M40 for us to be with us this evening, heading down from the Midlands, where they all first met. They are a virtuosic mix of alumni and undergrads from both Birmingham Conservatoire and the City's Academy of Music. Alex first picked up the saxophone, he thinks, at about the age of 10, just after getting the hang of both the organ and the piano. By the age of 12, somewhat concerningly, he was being booked to play at jazz clubs when most of us were settling down to some homework. And he already has a brace of awards to his name, and he's setting off in September for the prestigious Manhattan Music School in New York, which I believe boasts Herbie Hancock and Harry Connick Jr. among its alumni. So no pressure there then, Alex. Our poet this evening is Martha Spracklund, another youthful high achiever. She won the Foyle Young Poet of the Year award twice, started poetry magazine Cake in her first year at university, and that's still going from strength to strength, and she's currently assistant poetry editor for Faber and Faber, so right at the beating heart of the poetry scene, and we'll be hearing from her very soon. But starting us off this evening, it's the Alex Woods Quintet. Alex on sax, Andy Bunting on piano, Gareth Fowler on guitar, James Banner on bass, and Jay Davis on drums, with the intriguingly titled Blues for Why.
Thank you. the turn-off to Bodiel del Monte, your car touches the embankment. The gentlest meeting of wheel and earth, which sends the car upwards. Your eyes are in the rearview mirror, one hand on the wheel, the other leaving my thigh like a bird launched into sudden flight. Inside the car, there are only fractions. Your foot at the pedal takes years, my fingers reaching for you slow to milliseconds. And I remember, fleetingly, the lit sign over the motorway which you helped me translate. A 150 no se salva nadie. Remember when my mother visited? She sat in the back seat as we sped her along the vast strip of the M80. I felt so adult that day. In my city, with my lover singing songs in Spanish, my mother, the child, strapped into the back seat, not understanding any of the words. I was cavalier about the speeding, about the pipas and fag ends littering the bar floors, about the leering men, the reek on Calle La Palma. You're swearing. The seconds mount, endless, and we're suspended in the air, one tire blown, the others hanging redundant. Your breath covers me, cariño, chicle and cigarettes. Imagine the landing, the jolt and the clout of machinery. Or, if you prefer, imagine this, the ritual lighting of my cigarette from his. The engine silenced for the ascent, the land slipping away, undeserving. smouldering rise along the oil seed field, my double has me dream of the new cut lane. One of us is down there, climbing from the smashed window of Laura's car, cutting her fingers on the dash. Beside me, the other turns, my alter ego, second self, my lodestar, the one I've left behind in a shallow ditch in Lancashire. She's always trying to lure me home. Sometimes she fills my pockets with sand. Last week, there was an animal's skull on the kitchen table. Imagine that city foxes dream of the wild, of fat grain-fed prey, of black nights, of smoke and salt and the huddled cops on Brinkley Rise. One fox barks outside my window and I wake kicking a path through the bed covers, through the yellow dream fields, my legs syrupy and slow. My bleeding hand, no, the dream is clearing. My white, unwounded hand is held across my chest. The empty room is so clean and laughs at me, everything laughing as I leave the house. I've had this dream before. Billy is fumbling the back door handle, his nose spilling an elegant line of blood onto the seat. My fingers are torn. It won't be long, I know, until the gritty water is seeping in. Through the webbed glass, my other watches, then turns tail across the field, as the first curl of smoke rises from underneath the car. The night was so black there, all the stars visible and burning.
That was our first Proms Plus Late session, recorded last week at the Royal Albert Hall's Elgar Room with the Alex Woods Quintet and the poet Martha Sprackland. And the programme was introduced by Georgia Mann. There's more jazz in just over half an hour tonight on Radio 3. Jez Nelson is your host for Jazz on 3, contemporary jazz, and tonight a session from two experimental bands, Trio VD and Shatner's Bassoon, they're called. Jazz on 3 begins at 11 tonight. And before then, we continue with our current series of essays. The poet Wendy Cope takes a personal look at the pianos that she's known and played in her life. The Piano in Five Pieces is at 10:45 tonight here on Radio 3. In the meantime, music performed by one of Radio 3's new generation artists. She's Clara Morith, who actually is drawing close to the end of her time in the scheme, which seeks to give young and promising musicians lots of different high-level exposure throughout their time on the scheme. You may have caught her performing yesterday on Radio 3 with the first-ever guitarist on the scheme, Sean Sheba. But she's here with the pianist, who has played alongside many a member of the scheme, Joseph Middleton. This is a song by Duparc, the Romance de Mignon.
Thank you.
The Romance de Mignon, a song by Duparc, sung by Clara Moreith with Joseph Middleton at the piano. And she stays with that name, Mignon, to sing a song sung by a character called Mignon, as imagined by Tchaikovsky. This is one of six romances he composed in 1875. Each one is dedicated to one of the singers in the first production of his opera, The Oprichnik, or The Guardsman, which hit the stage a year earlier. This one was dedicated to a woman called Maria Karenskaya. "Only one who knows longing knows what I suffer," sings Mignon. "Alone and cut off from all joy, I look into the firmament in that direction." Mignon's Lament, Her Love is Far Away, Tchaikovsky's Mignon song, the third of a set of songs that make up his Opus 25. And it was sung by a member of the Radio 3 New Generation Artist Scheme, Clara Moreith, with Joseph Middleton playing the piano. Clara is to appear at the BBC Proms later this week. She's going to sing alongside the BBC Philharmonic on Thursday night, singing Fallier's Three-Cornered Hat, a tale of intrigue and jealousy shot through with the spirit of Spanish folk dances. Also on the programme, Beethoven's Seventh Symphony and Ravel's slow-burning and finally explosive bolero. And you can hear the world premiere of the next BBC commission in the season, music by John McCabe. It's called Joy Box. That prom begins this Thursday evening, live here on Radio 3 at 7:30. Well, let's hear one more song from Clara Moreith, this time a song by Wolf, one of his Goethe-Lieder, Kennst du das Land? Kennst du das Land, one of the Goethe-Lieder by Hugo Wolf, and it was sung by Clara Murith with Joseph Middleton playing the piano. And Clara Murith, a member of the Radio 3 New Generation Artist Scheme for just a little while longer. Do listen out, as I say, for Clara at the BBC Proms this Thursday on Radio 3. Ravel, she's singing Falia. There's also Beethoven and John McCabe to entertain you all from 7:30 on Thursday. But next tonight on Radio 3, we continue our series of The Essay. This week it's called The Piano in Five Pieces. And tonight, the poet Wendy Cope takes a personal look at the pianos that she's known in her life, exploring those from her childhood, including one that she still owns, which once belonged to her mother. Also, the highs and lows of piano lessons and the experiences of playing the piano as a teacher.
I don't know how my mother acquired her interest in classical music. It certainly wasn't from my grandmother, who lived with us when I was a child and didn't die until I was nearly 40. I don't remember her ever listening to music. My maternal grandfather died of TB when my mother was 9 years old. No one ever mentioned that he was keen on music of any kind. She must have discovered music at school, at church, and through friends. My grandfather worked in a factory. After he died, life was a struggle for his widow and daughter. I'm pretty sure they didn't have a piano in their flat. But somehow, by the time she married my father, my mother had taught herself to play. My father bought her a piano, a Broadwood upright from Harrods, and when I was very small, paid for her to have some lessons. I remember a Mr. Eastop calling at the house, the signal for me to be ushered out of the way by Nana. I've inherited much of my mother's music. There's a volume of Mendelssohn's piano works inscribed To Elsie with Love from Heather, with a date, 24th of December 1937. Elsie was my mother, and that date was her 21st birthday. Heather was a girlhood friend of hers, who later married a Canadian serviceman and emigrated. The Mendelssohn pieces are not the kind of easy stuff you'd give to a beginner. Elsie had evidently become quite a competent pianist by the time she was 21, 7 years before she married. There are also volumes of Beethoven and Schubert from the home series of the great masters, piano arrangements of Eine kleine Nachtmusik and of a couple of the better-known Bach chorales, piano selections from Iolanthe, The Gondoliers and Showboat, and the sheet music of some songs by Ivor Novello. I can't find Schumann's Scenes from Childhood. Perhaps my sister has got that one, but I remember my mother playing some of the pieces. I've still got her copy of Sullivan's The Lost Chord, which I learned to play and sing as a teenager. At the time, it seemed a wonderful discovery, and I would sing it over and over again. I grew out of that. And then there are hymn books. Before a recent house move, I cut down a bit on the collection of hymn books. I had acquired a few of my own in the course of my school days. My mother loved to play and sing hymns. So did I. I still do. And so did my sister. The three of us had difficult relationships with each other. Some, perhaps all, of our happiest times together were spent at the piano, with one of us playing and all of us singing. One of the pieces my mother played was the slow movement from Beethoven's Sonata Pathetique. Eventually, I learned to play it too. One day, when I was practising, my father said to my mother, "When I first heard you play that, I never imagined that one day we'd listen to our daughter playing it." That piece has continued to have a special place in my heart. We were used to hearing my mother play the piano and never, I'm sorry to say, thought of paying her any compliments. Daddy didn't play at all, or so we thought, until one day he sat down at the instrument and gave a performance of Chopsticks. We were bowled over. "Daddy! Didn't know you could play the piano. That's really good." He smiled modestly, while my mother went quiet. I had my first piano lessons at the age of 5 or 6. Although we weren't Roman Catholics, I was at the time a pupil at a convent school. My piano teacher was a fierce old nun. When I arrived for my second lesson, she asked me if I had practiced. I hadn't. I'd forgotten all about it. She was very cross, and if I remember rightly, she sent me away without a lesson. That didn't happen again, so I suppose I must have practiced a bit, but I don't remember enjoying it at all, and I didn't make much progress during the year or two that she taught me. After that, having come home one day and horrified my mother by asking for a rosary, I was sent to boarding school. My new piano teacher, Miss Ross, was less frightening than the nun, but I still wasn't an especially enthusiastic pupil. Miss Ross put me in for grade 1 and seemed surprised when I passed with merit. I was surprised too. A year or so later, she put me in for grade 2, which I passed without merit. When I turned 11 and moved up into the senior school, Miss Ross was still my piano teacher. We started working on the pieces for grade 3, but there was a problem, caused by the fact that I, like all my friends, was very keen on swimming. The school had an outdoor, unheated pool. We weren't allowed in until it had been 60 degrees Fahrenheit for 3 consecutive days. If they had let us, we would have broken ice to get in there. To my dismay, I found that my class's swimming time clashed with the time I was scheduled to practice the piano. I pointed this out to someone in authority, hoping they would change my practice time. No, it was tough luck. I would just have to miss swimming. There was no way I was going to do that. I missed piano practice almost every day. No one caught me. I failed grade 3. By the time I found out, I had left that school and was waiting to start at a new one. We were changing schools partly because my sister was unhappy. I had been quite happy at school and was fed up about it. Learning that I'd failed the music exam didn't improve my mood. I told my mother that I wanted to give up the piano. She said no. I argued and I lost. I'm grateful to her for putting her foot down. Another new piano teacher, Miss Cox. She was young and I liked her. Knowing that I'd failed my last exam, I think she regarded me as a challenge. I began to enjoy playing the piano. The ethos of the school helped too. A charismatic head of department had succeeded in making music the thing that everyone wanted to be good at, more so than sport. This was fortunate for me because I was completely hopeless at sport and in with a chance where music was concerned. I managed to get into the school choir. I took up a second instrument, the violin, so I could be in the orchestra, and I did my piano practice. When I first went there, the school didn't have a swimming pool. That may have helped too. When I passed grade 4, Miss Cox was as pleased as I was. If high fives had been customary in those days, we would have done one. I began to work even harder, sneaking into an empty music room, if I could find one, to do extra practice. At home, I campaigned successfully to have the piano put in a different room from the television so I could play it whenever I wanted to. By now an adolescent, I found that music was a satisfying way to express my emotions. I explored the contents of the music stool and taught myself to play and sing things that hadn't been put in front of me by Miss Cox. This was the lost chord phase I referred to earlier. I can't resist mentioning that I got distinction for grade 5. I remember the day the results were announced. A girl from my school had won the prize for getting the best mark in the whole country for grade 8 piano. That was exciting too. But music exams were stressful, much more stressful for me than academic ones. After my grade 5 triumph, I decided I wasn't going to do any more of them. What was the point? I wasn't going to take up music as a career. I just wanted to enjoy it. I regret that decision now because I'd like to be able to tell you that I passed grade 7, which I probably could have done, though I'm not sure about grade 8. I went on having lessons with Miss Cox until I left school. Soon after that, she left to get married, but we're still in touch. I didn't play the piano much while I was at university. I taught myself to play the guitar. Once I'd understood that you had to forget you could read music and just learn the chord shapes, I was surprised to find how easy it was to learn enough to accompany a huge number of songs. I didn't foresee that this new skill, or my ability to play the piano, would ever help me to earn a living. However, when I began work as a primary school teacher, they turned out to be very useful indeed. In those days, every primary school needed someone to accompany the singing in assembly and to take some class music lessons. I say in those days because I've no idea what happens nowadays. Do schools still have assemblies? Does the national curriculum allow any time for class music? Anyway, back then, a teacher with even a little bit of musical training was a valued commodity. I still sometimes dream that assembly is about to begin, I haven't practiced the hymn, and it's going to be an embarrassing disaster. Occasionally, my attempts to sight-read my way through a hymn tune were embarrassing. Mostly, I managed to stick to a repertoire of easy ones that I could play. As time went on, I introduced some folky religious songs that I could accompany on the guitar. And I gradually worked my way into a position where I was doing more and more class music teaching. Some years I didn't have a class of my own and just taught music through the school. I had a piano in my classroom and could play it as much as I liked at lunchtime and after school. But I didn't use the piano much in singing lessons. It's easier to keep an eye on 40 children while playing the guitar. And the music inspectors encouraged this, saying it was better to teach a song by singing it, and that a quiet accompaniment was more appropriate than bashing out a four-part harmony on the keyboard. Those music inspectors, employed by the late lamented Inner London Education Authority, were an inspiration. I went on courses where, as well as learning new songs, we worked in groups to compose our own music, with a view to enabling our pupils to be composers too. I found this work tremendously exciting. A supportive head teacher gave me the funds to assemble a wonderful collection of tuned and untuned percussion instruments. The children enjoyed themselves, and discipline was no problem because they knew that anyone who messed about wouldn't be allowed to play an instrument. One day, some boys found an old piano that had been dumped somewhere in the neighbourhood. The head and the schoolkeeper wheeled it into school, and the schoolkeeper dismantled it. We ended up with a horizontal piano frame on wheels. It was brilliant. You can make fabulous sounds on exposed piano strings. We bounced ping-pong balls on them. We stroked them with sticks, spoons and strings of beads. It was loud. The tolerance of teachers in the surrounding classrooms was astonishing. When I gave up teaching to be a freelance writer, I missed the children and I missed the music. I couldn't have a piano in my first floor flat, so I bought a touch-sensitive electronic keyboard. It was a lot better than nothing. Then, as now, I had phases when I played a lot and phases when I didn't play at all. In the playing phases, I mostly go back to the same old pieces, a certain Mozart sonata, one of the easier Beethoven sonatas, some easy Bach, and polish them up again. Eventually, I inherited my mother's Broadwood upright, which lives in my study on the ground floor. We couldn't face trying to get it upstairs. I've moved to an end-of-terrace house with a nice neighbour who is out at work 5 days a week. That means I can play without disturbing anybody except my partner, who can hear me from his study on the top floor. But he has always been positive and kind about my piano practice, just as my father was about my mother's. Having her piano in the house plays a big part in making it feel like home. But it is a responsibility. I'll finish with a poem I wrote about that. The Damage to the Piano. You can barely see the damage to the piano where the new bookcase knocked it, but all hell would break loose if my mother were here. I sit for several minutes pondering the silence where I am cast adrift with all this furniture and no one to tell me off.
That was the poet Wendy Cope reading her poem, The Damage.